I have to say, I get many speaking invitations. I've been privileged to get speaking invitations throughout my career, but there's nothing quite like a convention. The energy, the enthusiasm, the commitment when people who work on issues across the country have that opportunity to come together in one place at one time is really exciting. As you heard, before I became the chair of the EEOC, I spent more than two decades working in a range of organizations. I worked for the American Civil Liberties Union in their women's rights program and national legal program. I worked for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. But I spent more than half of my career working for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And in that context, I had the opportunity many times to attend the NAACP's annual convention, which, like this one, is such an exciting opportunity to share, even briefly, with people who are doing the important work across the country of activism, of organizing, and advocacy in support of human rights and civil rights and advancement of human rights and civil rights. So I want to start by saying congratulations and thank you to all of you for being present today. Thank you, President Maurer. Thank you to Christian Kuhnke, to all of the staff and volunteers of NFB who have invited and welcomed me so warmly to this event. This is my first time attending an NFB convention, and I am really delighted to be here. And I'll say that is true professionally, but it's also true personally. And I think the professional aspect is obvious. Among the laws that the EEOC enforces is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And clearly, it is part of my charge as the chair of the EEOC to work on behalf of the interests, the membership, the constituency of NFB to promote workplace equality for all workers across the country. But personally, it's also a privilege to be here because as I stand here, and really as I traveled here and throughout the course of my time here, I feel a very strong presence. My maternal grandmother, my mother's mother, died not long after I was born. Unfortunately, I don't have any memory of her myself. What I know of her is what I've seen in a few pictures, and what I know of her is what I have heard over the years from my mother. And one of the things that I do know, and that I know was a very important thing about her and her life opportunities, was the fact that as an adult, she was diagnosed with diabetes. Unfortunately, as a poor black woman who lived in a small town in rural Kentucky, she didn't have preventive health care. She didn't have access to preventive health care. So her diagnosis came at a very, very late stage in the disease. And not long after her diagnosis, she developed many complications, or many of the complications emerged. And one of those complications for her was a loss of her vision. So I can't, as I stand here today, tell you whether my grandmother ever had the chance to see me when I was an infant. But I do know that I feel very much her presence with me as I stand here today, and really as I carry out all of my work, and that one of the many things that has touched me throughout my life and inspired, encouraged, and preserved the work that I have committed my life to in advancing civil and human rights in many different forums is that memory, that knowledge, the awareness of some of the challenges she faced, not only because of her race, and not only because of her sex, and not only because of her lack of wealth in the rural South, in the pre-civil rights era, but also because of her blindness at that point. She did not have the opportunity that I do to be with you here at NFB. And I am glad that I'm able to stand before you and with you today, with her in my spirit. So thank you. I also want to acknowledge Assistant Secretary Martinez from the Department of Labor, and I'm not sure if he's with us yet, but Sam Bagenstals from the Department of Justice. As Assistant Secretary Martinez said, occasionally we get out of Washington. Well, for me, it's turning out to be quite frequent, and it is a very important part of what I do. But I do also have an opportunity to work in Washington with colleagues from the Department of Labor and the Department of Justice, all of whom are tremendous allies in the work of the EEOC. So I'm delighted to share part of this day with them as well. And I certainly want to acknowledge the EEOC presence today. Millie Rivera Rao, who is with us in the front row, who I know is no stranger to you at NFB, is a critical part of our staff in the Office of Federal Operations. And in absentia, I bring greetings from Chris Kaczynski, also well known to you and NFB. He was not able to make it, but I went to a meeting recently, and in the introductions, you know, I sort of got a standard introduction, and this was a meeting of our state and local fair employment practice agencies. I got a standard introduction, but the person who did the introduction for Chris ended by saying, he is the rock star of the EEOC. So we are very, very privileged to have staff like Millie and like Chris to contribute to our work in many, many different respects. Finally, I want to just briefly acknowledge Governor Patterson. Before I went to Washington, I'd lived 23 years in New York. So I was his constituent when he was serving as governor. We have been privileged, my husband and I have been privileged to have an opportunity to get to know and to work with him over the years. But there's something you won't see in his bio that I think is such a profound testament to who he is, and the fact that he will not only talks the talk, but he truly walks the walk. About 10 years after I finished law school, my law school roommate, who is now a professor of law at Northeastern University, developed diabetes and lost her sight as a complication. And as she was making the transition, she had practiced law for 10 years, worked as an advocate with sight. She had to begin to make a transition to practicing law now with limited vision. Governor Patterson immediately came to mind. And I asked her if she would mind if I reached out to him to see if he might talk with her about how he had been able to pursue law practice, how he'd been able to use his legal education, and what kinds of adaptive devices and other assistance might be available. I reached out to him. He immediately agreed to do it. And to this day, and I saw Hope Lewis about 2 months ago, to this day, she not only remembers it, but appreciates that immediate response. So, Governor, I hope I have not embarrassed you in sharing that, but I think it's so important for people to know it's not just the things that make it into your resume that matter. It is the work you do very quietly at times that truly is a testament to your commitment to the principles and values of NFB. I am a biography buff, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading about the life of NFB founder Jacobus Ten Broeck in preparation for this convention. I noticed that one of the authors who wrote about Dr. Tenbrook, said that to her as a member of NFB, his work in the really as a pioneer of the disability rights movement was well known, but she knew less about his legal scholarship. And the interesting thing for me is that because of my background and work as a civil and constitutional rights lawyer, I had just the opposite appreciation for Dr. Tenbrook's contributions. I knew very well that some of his work in legal scholarship had contributed to and was part of the architecture of the cases and briefs that led to the Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus Board of Education. And I knew that he was the one who challenged, through his legal scholarship, the Supreme Court's initial endorsement of the internment of Japanese American citizens during World War II. So when I think about that, and now have had the privilege, because of this opportunity, to learn more about his life of activism, his founding of NFB, his really far ahead of his time vision for what NFB would be and what the disability rights movement would become, I think he is truly an example of a person who lived a life that demonstrates the truth of what Dr. Martin Luther King called the inescapable web of mutuality. Like other giants of his generation, people like Bayard Rustin or Dr. Dorothy Height, and we could name many others, he challenged injustice on multiple fronts, and he must truly be defined as a human rights activist and leader whose work and whose scholarship and whose leadership continues to inform and guide many, many movements in this country. So I am really delighted to know more about his work in NFB, and I hope that someone will soon write a book about his life, because certainly the pieces that I learned through your website and publication were fascinating. I had a hard time putting it down when I was preparing. Let me say something about what the EEOC is doing, and particularly the issues. I don't want to say the issues that will be of particular interest, because I think that just as Dr. Tenbrook's life teaches us that human rights cross boundaries, human rights and a human rights framework does not look at just one aspect of one's identity. Everyone who is here has multiple aspects of their identity and may therefore be subject to multiple forms of discrimination in the workplace and in other settings. My work has always focused on issues of rights from a coalition perspective, appreciating that, as Dr. King said, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So I approach the work of the EEOC, and I believe that as chair in this first year, in and how we have done our work, we've recognized that there are multiple aspects of our work that may touch upon anyone in the workplace. So certainly we have done some significant things concerning the enforcement of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act. The first one, and if I were standing here this time last year, I could not say this. The first one is to say that we have implemented final regulations implementing the American with Disabilities Amendments Act. That was long awaited, I know. And one of the first orders of business for the commission, which, as you know or may know, was without a quorum for some time and could not take action on important regulations until the recess appointment and then eventual confirmation of three new commissioners last year, was to take up the unfinished and long-delayed regulatory business. And we all recognized that one of those issues was to pass final regulations implementing the very, very important legislation, the American with Disabilities Amendments Act, Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act. And we did that. We also passed regulations that for the first time implemented the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, all within our first year of service. We have returned to a regular schedule of commission meetings that are focused on examining and addressing issues that are emerging issues of workplace discrimination or that may require further action or guidance from the commission so that workers and employers understand fully the laws that we enforce and what they require. So in the past year, the commission has held meetings on a range of topics, some of them directly related to Americans with Disabilities Act enforcement, but others not directly related, but we have nevertheless made sure that the testimony we received and the record that we have built before us as a commission has addressed the impact of different practices by employers or different policies or different sorts of treatment in the workplace, how those policies, practices, or types of treatment may impact all workers, including workers with disabilities of all kinds. So, for example, in February, the commission held the first ever meeting on an emerging practice by employers, advertisements, and other efforts to exclude unemployed people from pools of job applicants. I will say that again. I think sometimes people believe they didn't hear that right. We learned in the past year that there were some businesses, some search firms, some search engines, some online sites that were posting ads that specified that unemployed people should not apply, or that specified that only currently employed people should apply, or only recently unemployed people should apply. After we received these reports, we took a closer look. We wanted to get a better sense of whether this was an isolated or a recurrent practice. And then we began to assemble a panel of witnesses who could help to inform the commission about not only the prevalence of the practice, but also the impact of the practice. And we heard not only from representatives of any of the groups that were immediately identified as possibly affected in a disproportionate way by this practice. Many people know that the unemployment rate for African Americans, for example, is substantially higher than the unemployment rate overall. But we also recognize that that practice had the potential to discriminate against people who might have been absent from or taken leave voluntarily from work in order to assume caregiving responsibilities, child-rearing responsibilities, or for medical leave purposes. So we heard testimony about the impact on disabled workers as well. We heard testimony about the impact on women workers as well. And we've also been able to explore and to consider how the practice would affect workers with disabilities or their caregivers. We have worked closely with the Office of Personnel Management to address the issue of discrimination in the federal workplace and to ensure that more and more barriers to the full employment of people with disabilities, including people with targeted disabilities, advances as President Obama's executive order requires all of the federal government to do. And you know that Millie Rivera is a tremendous resource from our agency on these issues. We're working closely with the Department of Labor and Department of Justice in enforcing laws that prohibit pay discrimination, and particularly we're part of the National Equal Pay Enforcement Task Force and working very closely with our federal government partners on those issues. We work with our state and local Fair Employment Practice Agency partners on a very broad range of issues, including enforcement of laws that prohibit discrimination on the basis of disability. Significantly, Just this week, the agency entered a settlement with Verizon. It is the largest settlement in the history of the agency in an ADA case. We settled for $20 million on behalf of employees who were terminated or disciplined when they took leave for medical reasons. We are busy. We have an active and broad agenda. I've only been able to touch on a tiny bit of it this morning, but the most important message I want to leave you with is the EEOC is excited about what the next years hold, because we have done much to advance the promise of equal employment opportunity in our first 45 years of existence. But we know that the work is unfinished. We know that the agenda is still full. We know that there is still much to do. And I am excited that the National Federation for the Blind is one of our partners, one of our allies, and one of our very, very important sources of information and support in the field as we carry out that work. So I look forward to spending time with you and your leadership today, and I trust that in and through my tenure, I will have more opportunities to work with you as we advance the promise of equal employment opportunity across the nation. Thank you.